Matt is a pastor and professor and is looking forward to teaching. He teaches undergrads in a community college, which is a wonderful profession, but he's hoping maybe for a little more attentiveness. Is that correct statement?
Less looking at your phone.
So I can tell you, right, no phones here. And of course, we always tell the family how wonderful, engaged Holden guests are, so he's looking forward to engaging each of you tonight. He is a professor of Eastern religion, and tonight is going to focus on Hinduism. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you. As we begin, and as people are coming in, I want to lead us through just a very short meditative exercise, if that's okay. So I invite you to participate at the level that you're comfortable participating. I think there is this notion that meditation is something that is supposed to bring us peace and serenity, and it's supposed to be wonderful, and we're all going to become yogi masters as we meditate. But actually, meditation, as I've discovered throughout the years, can be something that is unsettling at times, that brings up lots of emotions in us. And a quick story about this. About 6 months ago, I've been working with a group of young men at an Oxford House, which, if you're not familiar with what the Oxford House is, it's a drug rehab inpatient living situation. Basically, these guys really screwed up. And they have serious felonies on their records. They've done serious crimes related to drugs. And so they have an opportunity to rehabilitate their lives. So they brought me in as a resident theologian to talk about spirituality with this group of reformed and reforming addicts, if I can use that language to talk about addicts. And as we talked, we had a few sessions, and I led them through a meditation exercise. 5 minutes of silent meditation, and at the end of it, I said, how did that feel for you guys? And I was expecting bliss and wonderful things. All of them were angry. So much anger and rage and resentment and fear came from within them because it was one of the few times that they had to sit with themselves. They were angry with, they were projecting their anger at each other, at themselves, at the directors. And it was one of the first times that I've led meditation that that was the reaction. And I was, quite frankly, didn't know how to deal with it. So just a very quick, I want to invite you, you can keep your eyes open, keep them closed, but I want us to be mindful of where we're at in this moment. And so just, it'll be real brief, participate in your comfort level. I want you to think about where you're at in your bodies. How does your body feel this evening? Are you tired? Are you worn out? Did you go on a hike today and did it just spend all your energy? Do you feel energized and ready to go? Does your body feel achy and painful? Are you restless in your body? Did you not sleep well last night? Or do you feel ready to go? Do you have energy? Do you have enthusiasm in your body? And I want you to think about next, after you think about your body, where are you in your mind? What are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the list that you left at home? The kids? Are you thinking about what I might be saying or what you're bringing to this? Are you uncertain? Are you sure? And finally, where are you in your spirit? And when I say the word spirit, what I mean is how are you connected? Connected to God? Connected to each other? Connected to yourself? Do you feel distant from God? Do you feel distant from your neighbors? Are you disconnected from somebody back home? A spouse, a friend, a child? Do you feel close to God in a way that's giving you energy and enthusiasm? Do you feel disconnected from God, wondering if God is out there anywhere? how do you feel in your body, in your mind, in your spirit? And know wherever you are is exactly where you need to be in this moment. Take some deep breaths in. And let it out. Let's do that 2 more times. Thank you. So I recognize in this room, I want to begin our conversation first to say that what I'll be doing today is kind of begin at 10,000 feet. So we're really high. We're getting this big, broad picture. And over the time we have together, slowly be coming back down, I guess not to sea level, because we're not at sea level. We're at 2,000 feet. How high are we here? Three? Thank you. We're pretty high. So we're gonna slowly come back down, but use that as a metaphor to start with a big, broad brush strokes, and then slowly bring us down to very small details. So as if you're looking high up the sky. But I want to begin a conversation about social context and how important that is, and how important that is to Hinduism, how important that is to Eastern religion, and also how important it is to what we bring to the table. And so social context, as I understand it, is sort of the water in which we swim. So far off on the horizon, there's a small boat that you can't really see. Think about that as you. You're the small person on that boat there. All around you is the social context. It's the water that you're swimming in. So there are things about our social context that are obvious, are explicit, are aware, and there are also things about our social context that aren't as obvious. So, for instance, my social context, if you look at me, you're going to guess that I'm male. I identify as male. That's part of my social context. It's part of my connection. One of the things that you might not know about me is that I identify as a practicing Christian. So that's a part of my social context. It's kind of the group that I belong to. Just real quickly, what are some obvious social context groups that you belong to? Just go ahead and throw them out. Anyway, social context, obvious things.
Senior.
Okay, age. Yes.
Church.
Yes, religion. Yes, others.
Economic,
yes. If you're here at Holden Village, I can guess that you have a certain economic status. And that's not meant as a dig at you. It's just no, and that you probably have a certain financial means to be here in this place. So that's in your social context. Yeah, other things that might be obvious parts of
your Northwesterner.
Northwesterner, yes.
Live in Minneapolis.
You live in Minneapolis. Your region, your geographic area, yes. Social context, yes.
Education.
Say that again.
Education.
Education, yes. So that begins to fall into the sort of implicit social context. And let's go ahead and go there. What are some things that are not so obvious that I maybe wouldn't know about you or your social context?
Sports affiliation.
Sports affiliation.
Family.
Family, yep.
Political.
Political affiliation, whether or not you're Republican or Democrat or neither.
Yep. Ethnicity.
Ethnicity, yep. That's one that we kind of, it falls into this category where we sometimes make the assumption. I can look out at you and assume that a lot of you are Caucasian, but I don't really know that. That's just an assumption that I make.
Personal philosophy.
Personal philosophies. If we dig a little bit deeper, we might talk about things like sexual orientation. That might get us into a deeper kind of where you're connected.
Illness.
Yep. Your able-bodiedness, your abilities. Yes, that's certainly part of your social context. This is important because we all live in these different worlds, right? We all have these waters that we swim in. And in Hinduism, as we understand it, we cannot talk about Hinduism without talking about the social context of India. And so, before I get there, so the social context of India defines Hinduism. And as we get to it, we'll get there. India, the term India and the term Hindu are actually derived from the same word. And that isn't to say that everything Hindu is Indian or everything Indian is Hindu, but they're really closely connected with one another. And we'll get there and we'll talk about it. So I want you to sort of begin to think about that. I'm going to go really quickly through a couple things. This is how we talk about, in the classes I teach, we talk about why do we study religion. So from an academic standpoint, why do we study religion? So there's a couple different things we can study. Compassion and empathy, which I find really fascinating, can deepen your own beliefs or faith or your practices. Or it's an opportunity to deconstruct things. Anybody in here an auto mechanic? Nobody? Yeah. Sort of. Yeah. Awesome. So one of the best ways to understand something is to take it apart, right? And so one of the things that we do in religious studies when we talk about Hinduism or Islam or any religious perspective is that we deconstruct it. We look at it, we take it all apart. But one of the dangers of deconstruction is that we end up with a lot of loose parts and we don't know how to put it back together. So this is why I use the metaphor of a car mechanic, because oftentimes if you're a car mechanic, when you put everything back together, you want all the pieces to be there. There's a kind of classic cliche of the put back together engine and there's four or five parts that aren't with it, right? This can happen when we deconstruct religion. And so part of what I want to be mindful of as I talk about Hinduism and its relationship to compassion is to not deconstruct it so much that we're left with a bunch of pieces and we don't put it back together. Because we want to honor Hinduism. We want to honor those who are adherents of that faith perspective. And we want to be able to reconstruct it into something good. How many of you went to seminary? If you're willing to share, right? Okay, so seminary, if you went to a seminary, particularly a progressive seminary, this is something that seminaries are really good at, deconstructing everything and then not putting it back together. And so this is, you know, pastors who are trained to do theological, they'll say, okay, let's take this Bible and we'll take it all apart and we'll just rip it up, and then there's never an opportunity to put it back together. So we're going to be careful not to do that. So when I use the word religion, I want to tell you what I mean. So this is important. So the word religion, a couple different Latin words that it comes together, re and lig, which means to reconnect. Lig from the word ligament, and re meaning again. And so a very basic definition of religion is reconnecting. And so I define that as reconnecting it to the Logos, which is not necessarily the Logos that we read about in John chapter 1, but more the Logos as a Greek term that means the center and meaning of all things. That's the word in Greek. So we reconnect with God, we reconnect with each other, and we reconnect to ourselves. Right? This is what religion does for us. This is just a quote I like from Ronald Bullheiser. Spirituality is the fire within us. One of the things that we could say about Hinduism is that it's very passionate, and there's a lot of fire within it, and we'll get there. So, real quickly, lots of stuff, but I'm trying to get through it all. Six Features of Religion by Houston Smith. I'm kind of jumping into this, but there's a couple different things. Anybody know who Houston Smith is? Anybody read Houston Smith? Anybody had an opportunity to study with Houston Smith? But you, so Houston Smith is a writer, writes a lot about world religions, and he's a practitioner, been around the world, studied at many, many different places. Wonderful man. So if you want to know more about world religions, Houston Smith is a really good place to start. And he says that there are six features of most religions. One is authority. One is ritual. One are certain explanations. One is tradition. And one is grace. One is mystery. So I know that's really quickly. I'm going to unpack those just a little bit. So authority. In our Christian traditions, where does our authority come from?
The Word.
The Word. The Scriptures, right? What else?
The pastor.
The pastor. The pastor with a clerical collar. Where else does our authority come from?
Apostolic traditions.
Apostolic traditions, depending on your... Unless you're disciples and then you you know, reject all those creeds. Anybody disciple of Christ in this room? Yeah, they're a bit way against creeds. Anything else? Any other places of authority?
Yes.
Where?
You have to have an inner sense of authority that resonates with the exterior authority, otherwise you just don't even honor the exterior authority.
Right. Find it within. Right, so authority, also, what about, this is what I'm looking for a word, I'm not giving you a prize if you get it, but the authority of the
church.
The community,
yes.
Right? The authority of the community, right? There's a certain amount of authority we find in the community. One of the things in Hinduism that we find is that Hinduism, at least historically, is a very communal faith. There is no one major way to believe. Now, if we set aside the political, we currently have a pretty nationalistic prime minister in India, and I'm not going to talk about that. But we have a very broad perspective, and the authority really rests within the community from a Hindu perspective. All right, couple rituals. So we define ritual about celebration and its opposite, bereavement, expression, when tragedy strikes, joy, all sorts of things. Ritual are things like communion and baptism and
Marriage,
and what else? What other rituals do we have?
Funerals.
Right, certain things we do. In the Lutheran traditions, how many Lutherans do we have in the room? So many Lutherans. Oh my goodness, so many Lutherans. I'm just kidding. Lutherans have a shared sense of a ritual in their liturgy. Right? Very liturgical tradition, as we see. And always, I'm really inspired by that liturgy. So, every religion out there has a certain explanation of how did we get here? Where are we going? What's ahead for us? Within Christianity, particularly, one of those explanations is that we're on this earth, on this journey. Part of that tradition is about the created world. Hinduism is very much that as well. But what we find in Hinduism is that often the explanation is not about the end point, not about where we're going, but about the cycle of life that just keeps going over and over and over again. We'll talk about karma just a little bit. Tradition, which is somewhat similar to ritual, but a little bit different. Grace. Belief and assurance that realism, that's the spelling there, gosh, and mystery. Beyond finite, the human mind cannot fathom the infinite that envelops it. One of the great things about Hinduism that I enjoy is that it really captures mystery in a really profound way. If you've ever traveled to India or studied Hinduism, you know that it's full of mystery. It's full of questions. There aren't a lot of answers. And that's one of the things that I'm really drawn to in the tradition in myself. All right. So, just again, for our purposes. This is from the Pew Research Center. This is what the makeup of the world looks like right now as far as religious adherence. You'll see that Christianity is number one. No, that's not what I mean. We have the most, right? A couple different things happening there. Hinduism's fine, number four. This is more of a map of the world where these different religions abide. You'll see Hinduism primarily in the brown region over here. That's just how it's color-coded. The light green is Protestant Christianity. The darker green is Roman Catholic. So the tiny little red country, right? Israel is represented as Judaism. These are kind of the most prominent religion in these regions. So we see, as far as geography, Hinduism is actually fairly small over there. Pew Research Center, some takeaways on religion as we talk about this. What we see over and over again in the research is that Islam is one of the fastest growing religions in the world. How many of you have been a part of the church for more than 20 years, right? Most of the people are. I know for me, when I started in ministry 20 years ago, I was told that the church was dying, right? Nobody wants to come to church anymore. Church is not relevant anymore. Things are dying. Well, I've been told that for the last 20 years, and the church is still going, right? We're still kicking, right? We're still making it happen. It's still going. And interestingly enough, that spirituality and religious adherence is on the rise in the world. So even though we find that atheists and agnostics and other people who don't affiliate with religions are increasing in different parts of the world, they actually will begin to make a decline in the world's population. So if we go back to our list for a moment. This number three, which seems staggering, a lot of non-believers people, this, over the next 20 years, will start to slowly be less and less, more religious adherence. So people are looking for and longing for the sacred. I think this is what it's telling us, in so many different places. Okay. India retains a Hindu majority, but will also have the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, surpassing Indonesia. Really fascinating. As we go back to our conversation about social context, this is changing India and the Indian world dramatically. Because India is one of the oldest countries, a civilization that goes back, 8,000 BC, and for centuries upon centuries have retained a sort of identity closely connected with their religious perspective. And that's beginning to change. So I believe, and again, not to go into this in a great deal of detail, this is why we begin to see the rise of nationalism, right? We have an Indian prime minister right now who is extremely nationalistic. And why? Because he's afraid, right? We do, and nationalism is so enticing, especially because there's so many people who are afraid. Like if we look at our own country, right? The people in this country that are buying into the sort of nationalistic identity, it speaks to their fear. It speaks to their worry. It speaks to their concern. So not that I'm embracing nationalism, but just to say, I think I can understand why. It makes sense. Everything is changing in the world. The world is on fire, and things are just shifting and changing and growing. And so one of the responses is to try to lean in and to understand the world. The other response is to try to hold back. The other response is to try to retain control, which, as we all know, is never possible. The more we try to control, the worse it gets. So Christians begin to decline in the United States. Judaism will no longer be the largest non-Christian religion, which I could probably guess which one it is, which is Islam, right? But we also see that Christianity is growing in other parts of the world. It's kind of a non sequitur, but it's related to this whole story. So why does this all matter, right? Why did I just say all these things? We're going through a lot of pieces, right? It's about cultural competencies and understanding. All of these concepts and ideas are really important if we want to understand different religious perspectives and engage in a fruitful and productive interfaith dialogue and interfaith understanding. So this is all important, right? Everybody knows this is the swastika, right? But not really. We have to flip it this way to be a swastika, right? Anybody know this symbol?
You do.
Yes, right. This is a prominent Indian symbol. It's an ancient symbol developed in Hindu culture as a symbol that points to larger, more complex realities. There's a great video that I'm not showing you because I don't have the bandwidth, but about children in an Indian village who draw this symbol in the dirt as a sign of good luck, as a sign of wishing prosperity on their community and their world. It's a kind of a good luck charm. So as we understand more about these faith traditions and where the world is going, we can engage in a fruitful and healthy dialogue. Now, most people, when they see this symbol, it represents hate, right? It represents the worst of the worst of the worst. As we begin to understand more about the world, we can have more compassion and tolerance.
What did the dot stand for in the tradition?
The That's a really long answer, but I will tell you. I will tell you later. Not, but I will get to it. Yes. So
okay, thank
yes.
You.
So the short answer of that is it has to do with the four directions of the world.
Okay.
That's the short answer.
Okay.
So yeah, recognizing wisdom from all places.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So some guiding principles and definitions as we're talking about Hinduism and religious studies up here on the board. We want to talk about transcendence, immanence, dualism, pantheism, pluralism. Some of these words are probably familiar to some of you. So I'm going to go through them quickly. So transcendence is a word that means above and beyond. Transcendence refers to any reality that exists beyond nature, right? Something supernatural. Another way to think about it is if we put all of the world in this room and we looked outside of it, there would be some divine reality, right? Depending on how you see the world, you might believe that transcendence there. Can refer to a god or a god, an ecstatic experience or an expression of a higher power. Transcendence. Immanence, on the other hand, is something we find that's hardwired, that's built in. It's part of who we are. It's created. From a religious perspective, immanence often refers to the nature of things. In Hindu notion of the true self, or the Atman, which is what we see. This is, as we filter out all of the distractions in the world, we begin to come closer and closer to understanding that the divine reality exists here. In us. It's imminent in our bodies. Dualism, another word I want to throw out. This is a belief system that the world operates with two distinct natures, sometimes but not always in competition with one another. This is the primary difference between Christianity and Hinduism. Right? In Christianity, we firmly, last night we had a baptism, right? Remember all those renouncements? All that evil stuff, right? All that stuff where we're talking about renouncing the evils of the world and we affirm the goodness of the world, right? This is one of the things that we have to, if we want to understand Eastern religions, we have to understand this dualistic notion that things are either here or here doesn't exist in Hinduism. There is not a right and a wrong. There's not a good and a bad. There's not a devil and God. There's not a heaven and a hell. It's all a part of this kind of universe working together. And there's some famous parables that we could talk about. Mainly, when bad things happen, it's not necessarily always a sign that the world's out to get you, right? We can think about that as we look around us and we see the fires, right? Great destruction with the fires. But what does that fire do? It restores nature in a way that we could never do on our own. You drive through Yellowstone, every year there's a part of Yellowstone that gets burned. Every year. When you drive through that same part the next year, you'll see so much beauty beginning to emerge, right? So we have to think about this in that way. Pantheism or monism or one nature or God in all things. This is another thing that we, if we want to understand Hinduism, that we have to really grasp. And that is this idea that God is in all things. Just take that word and separate it into two different words. Pan meaning all and theism meaning God, right? Pantheism, all living things have God in it, that God exists in all things. Even, you know, the wood used to be divine. And in some ways it still is because it was once part of the natural world. The Brahman, which is part of the Hindu reality, is considered to be both transcendent, immanent, divine reality in all things. So, as we try to develop this category, so we say, is Hinduism all about immanence, or is it all about transcendence? And the answer is yes. Right? And this is one of the most frustrating things that I find when I work with students, is that their brains cannot wrap it around here. Well, wait a minute. How can something be both and? Right? As we understand Eastern religions, we have to understand the both and. Yeah.
Can you say a little more about Vedas, please?
So the Vedas is a Hindu scripture. So it's just a part of the Hindu scripture that speaks more to the many natures of God. So it's kind of a sacred scripture, like a biblical text would be.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so where are we going? What are we trying to get to? When I teach my students, I'm trying to get them to have an academic understanding, but when I'm teaching people from a church context, we're trying to get to this idea of pluralism, this idea of unity or togetherness, acceptance and affirmation of oneness. It's not just about tolerance, but it's about true and deep understanding, recognizing truth in all stories. Another thing to say about Hinduism that is difficult for some Christians to really grasp is the idea that truth can be manifested in many different ways. We think about truth with a capital T. There's one overarching meta-narrative that describes all things. Not so in the Hindu or the Eastern world. There is truth in many different writings, and truth in all stories. Right, and so I kind of said this already. So the other really interesting thing that we find in Hinduism is, on the surface, we think of Hinduism as a polytheistic religion, right? If you do a search for Hinduism, what you're going to find is about 1,000 different manifestations of God and goddess, right? The iconography in Hinduism is beautiful and wonderful and varies in its tradition. Certain Hindu philosophers will argue that really Hinduism is more of a monotheistic religion because it represents that God, there's kind of one overarching force that guides all of these things. That's a difficult conversation for another time. Okay, I'm good, fine. So, the Bhagavad Gita is one of the most well-known and well-read texts found in the Hindu tradition. And speaks a bit on intention. I like this quote. The meaning of karma is in the intention. The intention behind the action is what matters. Now, we can have a whole conversation about that, right? So I see people going, well, wait a minute. But yes, so Bhagavad Gita, so, and we'll get there. All right. So, 10,000 feet. Right, we're starting to come down a little bit, okay? This is broad brushstrokes of what it means to study religion, what it means, what these guiding principles, these ideas, these concepts, begin to focus more on specific elements. As I said before, India and Hindu derive from the same word, Indus. That's a collection of stories, histories, traditions, gods and goddesses. Like, not unlike our Abrahamic traditions, Hinduism began as an oral tradition. Right? It began as a collection of stories. It began as a group of people sitting around a campfire trying to understand the world and creating stories and artwork and things like that. The difference between Hinduism and Christianity is that I believe that process of collecting stories and creating is an ongoing one. Whereas I think sometimes, and this may be a critique of Christianity, sometimes we forget that God is still speaking, right? We forget to continue that God's work is still happening in the world, that stories are still creating, that the authority is, yes, in the biblical scriptures, but that the community continues to create that story and has new traditions and new authority and new ideas. We sometimes can get too locked into that little book that's supposed to be just a collection of stories, right? We could have that conversation too. So what creates Hindu culture and what creates Indian culture are often parallel. As I said, there's no overarching meta-narrative, which is problematic for some students of religion. There are sacred scriptures, ancient stories, and shared principles in most of Hinduism, but no one story. Okay, we're beginning to focus more. Just a really broad Hindu timeline. We go back to 2000 BCE. The Harappa culture dominates the Indus River Valley, which is now India. This culture lived in relative peace and harmony for many, many years. About 1500 is the creation of the Vedas, which is that sacred Hindu text. Somewhere between 200 BCE and 200 CE is the creation of the Bhagavad Gita, which becomes a very guiding force for the Hindu tradition. 1200 CE is the entry of Islam into the northern India, which changes things. Again, another topic. And 1750, perhaps the most prominent change we find in India is colonialization, right? As Britain decides it wants to take over the world and colonize everything and everyone, right? It changes India dramatically. But what happens from colonialization is really fascinating in Indian history and stories. Most of us are familiar with Mahatma Gandhi and his story. This kind of arose out of a protest against the sort of colonial influence. So about 1947 is when we see democratic independence, so which is an ongoing process. So if we think about the state of Hinduism in India and the world, that wasn't that long ago, 1947, a break from colonialism. So there are a lot of reasons for the Indian government, nobody walk away saying I'm justifying nationalism here, but there are a lot of reasons for the Indian government to be very afraid of outside influence, because they lived for quite a long time under the thumb of a powerful empire, the British Empire, I think we can call it that. So there is many reasons to be fearful of that. It changed who they were dramatically. And it's still changing. If you look at a world map of India, what you often will find is the cities that are named in India with another city next to it in parentheses, right? India is still in the process of going back and reclaiming some of those names that they lost during British colonialism, which is a big thing. And we can relate that to our own experience as we're beginning to tear down statues of Confederate leaders and racist leaders, and this is one of the big things on college campuses, and let's rename every building because they were all a bunch of racists, right? It's true in so many ways. My father was just like, well, when are we going to stop? And I was like, until we all can find healing, that's when we're going to stop, right? And so this is what India is doing right now. They are trying to heal from the pain of colonialization, as is the rest of the world, right? All right, so the Vedas. You asked about the Vedas. Here we are. We're back. One of the fascinating things, colonialization, the Sanskrit texts, the sacred texts of Hinduism, weren't translated until colonialism happened. So not until the 18th century did these ancient texts get translated from Sanskrit into other languages. So, yay, colonialism. Right? So this comes out of colonialism. Very interesting. So when it was translated, it was discovered that many of the stories, gods and goddesses, paralleled Greek and Roman mythology. They found parallels to Iranian literature and mythology, thus reinforcing this amalgamation theory of Hinduism. An amalgamation is what you get when you go to the dentist, right? And they blend it all together. That's what they call that. And now they put it all in and it makes it look like your original tube. Sort of the blending idea. All right. Continuing to focus on. So Purusha is one of the most prevalent metaphors and mythologies found in Hinduism. Purusha is said to be a god, goddess, that was the creator of the world. So Purusha looked out and saw the world and saw that it was broken, it wasn't working, things weren't going well, and decided to sacrifice him, herself, on the altar. So the story goes that Purusha was cut into thousands, perhaps millions of pieces, and then the remains of Purusha were sent out to all of the corners of the world. So that sacrifice created the world that we live in now. So let's go back to immanence and transcendence, right? This reality of this sacred god, goddess, was cut into a million pieces and now exists in all things, including us, right? At the heart of Hinduism is a story about sacrifice and a story about the interconnectedness of all of the world. Not just people, right? I'm not just connected to you and you and you and you, but I'm connected to the whole world because the whole world shares the same DNA. So at the heart of Hinduism is a story of sacrifice and interconnectedness that we all participate in. All right, so again, focus more. So Hinduism. One of the things that most people know about Hinduism is that it developed this idea of karma, right? What is karma? We kind of throw that word around as a cliche. Oh, that's good karma. Or oh, that's bad karma. You know, we do this. But karma really is a reference to sort of the wheel of life. We have birth. We're born. We struggle. We die. We're born. We struggle. We die. Pretty negative outlook on life. That is life, right? And unlike the Christian story that says at the end of our life we have some reward, or if we really screw up, we have a punishment, there's no such thing. It's just this endless cycle. Unless, in the Hindu concept, we are able to find liberation from that cycle of life, right? And this is where the story of compassion and tolerance and love comes in, right? Because it's this idea, if we want to just escape that constant life cycle and achieve what's called moksha, or liberation, we must find a way to do two things. One, find ourselves in this story, the story of sacrifice and the story of interconnectedness. Because the ultimate goal from a Hindu practice is to escape this cycle of life that's meaningless. There's no meaning in it. It's meaningless. Liberation. Yeah, but what on earth does that mean? Right? This is one of my favorite. Right? Kind of playing with ideas, right? Let's just do that. Is it heaven or is it nirvana? Is it enlightenment? Is it one with the universe? Yeah. This is one quote. It says by Michael Malloy, who writes a textbook. It is achieved by overcoming ignorance and desires. It is a paradox in the sense that overcoming desires also includes overcoming the desire for moksha itself. Yeah, right? It can be achieved both in this life and after death. Right? So you begin to see Westerners really just, oh, their brains are exploding. You're like, what? Wait, what? Part of Hindu understanding is embracing paradox. Right? Embracing the both and. Yes, something can be good and bad all at the same time. Something can be light and dark all at the same time. Paradox, that's part of it. But I like this overcoming ignorance and desires part, right? Knowledge is key. One of the things we learn about Hinduism, if we dive into the depths, is that it's very focused on knowledge, and I saw there's a reason I started with that brief meditation, because the idea within Hinduism is finding this deep connection with our bodies, finding a deep connection with our mind, and finding a deep connection with our soul or our connection with the world. Right? These are the three things. All right, this is a quote from the Bhagavad Gita that I want to read. Krishna said, in this way, you will be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me, Krishna, in this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. So, let's pray to God, Lord Krishna, always in life, so that we can go to God's abode. Then going to heaven, as we shall need to take rebirth after going to heaven, while we shall get permanent life in God's abode. It's hard to read, right? Let's pray to God always so that he can bless us in this and after this life. Loving and praying to God only can save us from the cycles of birth and death and from all types of miseries and life. All right, so, that's a big one, right? But let's go to this last one. Loving and praying to God only can save us from the cycles of birth and death and from all types of miseries in life. It's a release from one's own energy. Okay. Moksha is liberation. The soul's release from the cycle of death and rebirth. It occurs when the soul unites with the Brahman by realizing its true nature. Several paths can lead to this realization and unity. The path of duty, the path of knowledge, and the path of devotion. One path of union is to yoke with one's true self. Practices that provide balance, serenity, wisdom, peacefulness, to yoke or union with the true self. What's another word for yoke?
Bondage.
Bondage?
Connect?
Maybe?
Joy.
Connect?
Mm-hmm.
Yoga. This is where yoga comes from. The word yoke. Right? To yoke This is where yoga comes from. This is the root of that. So it's about connection and to connect with one another. So we practice yoga to connect with our bodies, to connect with our community, and to connect with God, right? I was very upset about the cancellation of yoga this morning. I was very upset about that. I was really looking forward to the yoga. I'm sure that was the universe's fault, right?
Well, it's because it was raining.
Okay, I won't go off. So, yeah, but so, but I will go off on that tangent because it's part of my own practice is to practice yoga, and it's supposed to provide this inner peace and calmness and serenity. But the minute I walked up to the kiosk and I looked, oh, that's where was yoga today? It was canceled. I was so upset, right? I was so mad. I was like, darn it, yoga's canceled. Right? And I was like, okay, there's a deep irony in the fact that I'm so angry about yoga being canceled. Right? I obviously have a lot of work to do to achieve that. Yoga. So in yoga, we have physical concentration, we have a practice of breathing, we have balance, right? For the most part, in Western practice of yoga, it's pretty much divorced from the spiritual practice. But yoga, at heart of Hinduism, is yoga practice. And so going back, there are at least 100 different types of yoga that we could talk about. And imagine some of you are yoga practitioners out there. And go for it.
Is there anything about Hinduism that would have resources to stand against something like the caste system?
We're getting there. You're so close. Okay. We're so close. It's exactly where I'm going with the caste system. Yes. Yes. So part of the yoga practice is about ethical principles, truth, nonviolence, cleanliness, devotion to God, non-covetousness, not being a complete jerk, you know, when yoga gets canceled. Yoga seeks to use asanas, or physical postures, to bring more prana, energy, and to open chakras that live along the spine. Right? This is the point of yoga. I already said that. Reflective, emotional, active, and experiential. There are the different types of yoga. For the most part, we focus on the active piece. Right? This is the way that we can look lean, that I can show off my muscles and my balance. Right? This is what yoga is for most Westerners. But I believe that some yoga practices are starting to get back to the sort of spirituality. Mm-hmm. I have one class and that I teach at the community college, and the lecture is called Hinduism and Lululemon. If any of you don't know the reference to Lululemon, it's a very popular form of yoga. Some of you might own Lululemon clothes. I'm not dissing on you, but I kind of am. Lululemon is a very popular brand of, it kind of epitomizes how yoga has become very materialistic. So it's a type of yoga pant. If you're not going to yoga class, you better be wearing different pants. That's awesome. Okay, moving on. A big part of Hindu practice. I'm going to get through this, I promise. A big part of the Hindu way of life is public worship, or puja, depending on your pronunciation. Often performed by Brahmin priests. These are public rites and rituals. If you visit India, particularly in the major cities, chances are you will encounter some sort of public worship experience. They have numerous festivals and feast days and things that are out in the public square. This is a very common part of their way of life. A practice called darshan, which is a visual contact with the divine. There are ritual fires around a sacred fireplace. Often Hindu practice is there's a death ceremony by fire and remains to be washed in a holy river. This is a Hindu practice to cover a body with flowers, to light it on fire, and send it down the river. So this is a very common practice. All right, caste system, right? Everybody always thinks about Hinduism. Caste system is connected. Let's talk about the caste system for one another. Where one finds themselves based on family of origin and labor divisions, also often heredity. In traditional Hinduism, we have these categories. right? The caste system. The Brahmins are up here, the priests and the philosophers, so all of you are pastors. Good job. You're up the top. Those who are nobility, kings, warriors, and the warrior's servants, the protectors, they're number two. The economic specialists, the farmers and merchants, the manual labor workers, the whole village workers, they're number three. And we have the outcasts, the untouchables, who removed human waste from the streets, swept the streets, workers of cow skins. So the caste system, however, was abolished in the 19th century for many reasons. Some of those reasons included the exploitation of British colonials, and Gandhi, who renamed the class, the outcast, as the children of God. We began to see some parallels there, right? Between Jesus and the story of Hinduism, right? The least of these, that's a part of our scripture, right? In 1948, this stigma was legally abolished of the untouchables, but there are still many traditional families that disapprove of marrying across those labor division lines. So I didn't want to leave that out of the conversation. I'm going to skip that. Okay. Gosh, ran out of time. All right, Bhagavad Gita. You are what you believe in. You become that which you believe you can become. So, how has Hinduism influenced Western culture? One of the things that I do with my students at a community college is that they always have to write a paper on what I call East meets West. That's how Eastern religion has impacted Western culture, Western philosophy, Western religions. We have the great 19th century transcendentalists like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Walt Whitman, T.S. Eliot, and even contemporary celebrities like Julia Roberts and Ricky Williams. 20th century scientist, Carl Sagan. This is my favorite quote from Carl Sagan. As far as I know, India is the only ancient religious tradition on the earth which talks about the right time scale. The Hindu concept is very clear. Here's a great world culture which has always talked about billions of years. So they've talked about how the world is so much bigger and so much longer and so much older. There are some more further influence. Buddhism, some argue that Buddhism was an attempt to reach a fuller Hinduism. There's some Trinitarian doctrine found in Krishna and beginning, middle, and end, right? That sounds familiar to some of you Christian theologians out there. Alpha and Omega. I like to think that Jesus was spending time in India. There's no real proof of that. Unless you read the book Lamb. Anybody read the book Lamb? The Gospel According to Ben? Yes, thank you. It's the most radical book out there. It's great, though. But I like to think that Jesus... But there are countless parallels we find between Krishna and Jesus, right? Krishna and Jesus were both born of a virgin. They were both called sons of God. They both descended to the place of the dead. They were both miracle workers. They were put on trial for their time spent with sinners, right? We're beginning to see some connections and some parallels between these two stories. In the Bhagavad Gita, if you're going to read anything about Hinduism, read that. It's one of the best poems and stories about basically two warring clans. It's a dialogue between the prince and his charioteer, Krishna, which actually is a god. Arunya's loyal power is threatened by his cousins, and he must decide to fight his family or succumb to their rule. So a challenge to his values of nonviolence. He is overcome with grief and sorrow, and it's Krishna who comes to his side. It's a good one. It's a good one. I'm going to skip that. Okay. So, I just painted this giant picture, right, in an hour of what Hinduism is. But again, we come back to Hinduism. It's a story, a constant story about sacrifice and interconnectedness and community. I believe if we look at the Gospels and if we go back to social context and what the world was like in the first century Mediterranean world, what we see is a world that's very, very focused on community. There is this myth in Western ideology that we are all individuals, right? Some of us have even believed that at times in our life, that I am my own person, right? And I got to where I was at because of all the hard work that I did. And that is this myth that we perpetuate in our society. And I believe Hinduism provides us with this avenue for understanding how we are interconnected with the world. Is it perfect? No. Does Hinduism have its own baggage and its own problems? Yes. But so does so do all the other religions of the world, right? We're all broken people just on this journey together. And so this is something that is deeply prevalent within Hinduism, is this idea of connecting with something outside of ourselves, or something bigger than ourselves. When we sit around in Holden Village, it's very easy to just walk outside and be like, the world is so much bigger than me, right? But how often we forget this in our day-to-day? How often we forget to be interconnected, to see God's world around us, to see the light in each other's eyes, right? And so this is one of the ways we can do this. And I believe Hinduism, as we understand it, as we can, I can talk for hours about the different practices and stories and myths, but I believe it is one of the ways in which we can find deep connection with the world, with ourselves, and with each other. So, yeah, that's all I've got.